Time, performed by Frenchie Joy and Jerome St. Jerome on the harmonica. Welcome to the Coon Rhyme Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, coming at you live from Skid Row Studios. I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. Our call-in number is 1-800-893-9562. Now, this week on the Coon Rhyme Report, our topic is the state of theater in the community, and I am delighted to have some special guests in the studio live. You'll be hearing from them in a minute. Now, this is our last broadcast at Skid Row Studios, and we will be restarting the Coon Rhyme Report the first part of the year. This is over 200 performances, 200 broadcasts at Skid Row Studios. I would like to thank Jeremy and Joelle for giving a voice to the downtown and Skid Row community. Our prayers go out to Brother Muhammad Ali Ajariji and his family as he recovers from a car accident. He also portrays historian J.A. Rogers in the play Catch the Tiger, and we will hear more about the play in the upcoming session. Let's go around the table and introduce yourself, tell our listening audience a little about your background, and how did you get off into theater? Let's start with Bill over here.
Bill White, I'm a producer and director of theater in Los Angeles, and I actually started back in New York when somebody asked me to fill in for them in a small production. And I did the lights.
I thought you did some acting for
No, I've also done acting.
Okay.
Yeah, but I much rather directing and producing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's move to Montel.
My name is Montel Harvey, and I got into acting maybe in 2005. And I came to Los Angeles modeling, and went to New York City to model, and everybody at every agency was saying, you have such a commercial look, you have such a commercial face, you should really look at acting. And I finally gave it a look, came back to LA and started to study Meisner and just fell in love with it. And I've been doing it ever since. A lot of theater, a lot of film, starting to get more into television and film, but of course, the theater is the artist's medium, in my opinion, and I love it there. So I've been doing it ever since then. It's been a wonderful ride.
Mm-hmm. Okay, TJ.
My name is TJ Bach. I'm originally from West Africa, Sierra Leone. Born in Sierra Leone, grew up in Liberia. So I always say I'm representing three countries: Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, where my parents come from. Mm-hmm. Came to the state in 2000, went to college in Missouri, St. Louis, moved to LA in 2005 to pursue acting because that has been my dream since I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And doing theater, for now I'm doing a lot of theater, so I'm trying to branch into TV and film. Mm-hmm. You know? But theater is like our number one passion.
Okay. Alexander.
Good evening, folks.
Good evening.
My name's Alexander Harris. I grew up in Northern California. Spent a lot of my life in the law enforcement field. Short time ago, I stumbled into acting. I took an acting class, and I loved it immediately. It was like a drug. I went to the class just to experience acting, because I was always an admirer of it. And after doing one scene, I couldn't stop. And since that time, I've done some television shows and movies and quite a few commercials, so I'm growing and branching out into theater is something I always wanted to do, so Catch the Tiger is the perfect form.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and we're going to talk about that. Shoot, I would love for you to do one of the monologues or something. That would be great. And let's turn to Stephen.
I'm Stephen Jager. Thanks very much for inviting me, Melvin. I'm delighted to be here. I had a career as a professor retired from University of Illinois in 2007, and got back to playwriting. I had written plays when I was younger, had one published, thought maybe I could make a career of playwriting. That didn't happen, but I had a nice ride as a professor. And so this play that we're going to talk about, that I'll talk about tonight, The Good Person of Bronzeville, I guess I would say it fell into my lap. I was inspired. The circumstances were right, and somehow it was a play I had to write. And,
okay. Let's talk about it for a while. I'd like to turn to Stephen, because you got a play reading coming up, The Good Man of Bronzeville, at the Vortex, Monday, August the 26th, 2015, at 7:30. Now, what is The Good Man of Bronzeville about? What is it about?
It's an adaptation of a play by Bertolt Brecht called The Good Person of Sichuan. And The Good Person of Sichuan plays in China. The gods pay a visit to Earth to find a good person. And they find one. She's a prostitute. And they give her a business. And then she has trouble maintaining the business because the world is tough and mean, and she's too good for it. I was living in Chicago and happened to be, had a part in Romeo and Juliet, a minor part, thinking of the theater again, and just happened to be reading the Brecht play, and I also lived in the black area of Southside, and I realized that it would be impossible to play the Brecht play for a black society, because the wrongs of society are poverty in the Brecht play. Poverty is the plague. Poverty is what holds people back from being good. And so, you know, rewriting it for the circumstances of life on the South Side of Chicago looked like a very productive, interesting, inspired thing. That's how it came about.
What's the biggest challenge in writing a play about the South Side of Chicago? And they call it Bronzeville there, too, right?
There is a section of Chicago called Bronzeville, South Side Chicago called Bronzeville. I lived in Kenwood, not the Kenwood with Barack Obama and Louis Farrakhan. That's the other side of the tracks. Yeah, the biggest challenge in writing this play. Well, I'm a white geezer writing a play about black people, and I did a huge amount of reading, and but also I had a lot of contact with local people. And the characters in the play, about half of them are real. That is, they were people I knew in Kenwood. So, you know, recreating persuasively a society that's not your own, that was a challenge. But I also thought that the situation of black people in Chicago and in the States generally at this time is, in a way, representative of problems much broader than racism, than racial politics. And, it's interesting that the classics of black literature tend to focus on black-white problems. Richard Wright, James Baldwin. But there's a phrase of Ralph Ellison that I had in my mind a lot writing this play, The Black Mask of Humanity. Black Mask of Humanity.
Is that from Invisible Man?
No, it's from an essay.
Okay. Yeah.
But, I mean, he wanted to see how the human condition generally gets embodied in the experience of black people. And he was calling for literature along that line. And it seemed to me that the circumstances of the economic blow up and the shooting of kids, the craziness in the justice system, called for exactly that kind of representation of the people who were suffering. Suffering was very focused on black people, but it was not a specifically black problem. Mm-hmm. It was
and America's
greater problem of the system. Yeah,
the person that they consider America's greatest playwright by many got a start by writing about the black community, writing about black people, and that was Eugene O'Neill.
Well, I appreciate the analogy.
Awesome playwright. I guess his most famous early piece is The Emperor Jones, in which made Paul Robeson famous, of course, in the film. Can you once again give us all of the basic information about the reading performance?
Oh, sure.
We'll come back and talk about it a little bit more.
Well, what's mainly important to announce is that the stage reading will take place on Monday, October 26th, 7:30 at the Vortex. The Vortex is at 2341 East Olympic in Los Angeles, and everybody is welcome, admission free.
Okay. We have plenty of food, too. Okay. Yes. Look who we just got in. Pedro, can you introduce yourself? Maybe somebody can give her the mic for just a moment.
Sure. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hello. And you are?
Hello. My name is Pedro. Mm-hmm. And yes, my name is Pedro Devril. I play Amy Jacques in Catch the Tiger.
Okay, we're gonna talk about that in a minute.
Okay,
shoot, I was trying to figure out for Bill to have somebody here that can do at least one little small scene. Maybe we can do this a scene with you and Marcus Garvey. The first scene, it might be a little tough, but I'll leave it up to the director on that. Let's move over and talk about
your iPhone first.
Let's move over and talk about Catch the Tiger. Bill, can you tell our listening audience what the play is about?
Catch the Tiger primarily deals with Marcus Garvey in the 1920s and J. Edgar Hoover's efforts to stop his proselytizing of black nationalism.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus Garvey was from Jamaica. He was he liked Booker T. Washington, and when he got to New York, he developed an organization, UNIA, and essentially his philosophy was black empowerment. He believed that black people should not necessarily segregate themselves, but to support each other and develop their own business and so on, marry each other. And in that way, you can have a more solid block to get what you want in a very racist society.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everybody knows about J. Edgar Hoover. And what is interesting about J. Edgar Hoover was that this was the first time that he developed a program that developed into what we know as COINTEL and so on, in that he would infiltrate the organizations, get information, and then send messages to various people within the organization to foment problems within the organization. That's how he got rid of the Black Panthers.
Mm-hmm.
He tried to do that with Martin Luther King. They say the same things were done with the gangs in Los Angeles and so on. So although it took place in the 1920s, it's very relevant to the present day. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we know our history. Marcus Garvey in his day attracted millions of people, not only in New York and in the U.S., but all over the world. In fact, his New World newspaper was banned in a lot of the colonies in in Africa because by the Europeans because they thought it was so incendiary.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, because it's coming from Jamaica, mm-hmm. you know, there is in the modern time there is a relationship between the Rastafarians, who have a close relationship with Selassie. But Marcus Garvey and Selassie was very hostile. I know Garvey was hostile towards Selassie. Well, how did that develop? What is the relationship now of the Rastafarians who have a close relationship with Selassie and also Marcus Garvey? But, you know, Garvey had a negative opinion of Selassie. And maybe you can tell
Garvey had a negative opinion with anybody who worked with the Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
And Haile Selassie did work to a great extent with the Europeans who finally mm-hmm. took over his country.
Can you tell the listening audience who was Selassie?
Selassie was the emperor of Ethiopia,
mm-hmm.
Who died, in the 70s. And after his death, Ethiopia broke up into factions. Now I think you have Eritrea, which is separate from the actual country itself.
Mm-hmm.
But with respect to Jamaica, when the Rastafarian cult was developed, they were not considered, they were considered alien to the Jamaican culture. Of course, at that time, the British were in charge of Jamaica. And as the years went on, Jamaica became more and more conscious. And now, perhaps out of all the Caribbean countries, it's the more Afrocentric country that we have now. But it was not an easy trip for them. They believe in that Haile Selassie was a god or mm-hmm. a prophet from God. And they smoke a lot of ganja in the sense that when they, marijuana, so... Yeah. It opens their mind to communicate with God.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it was, I guess it was Bob Marley. He was
Bob
that,
Marley
that really
was
connected to two, Marcus Garvey and Selassie.
Yeah, Marcus Garvey is a national hero of Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Jamaican culture has since gravitated towards Marcus Garvey. The Rastafarian considers him a prophet. As I keep telling you that song from
Redemption song
mm-hmm. when he says emancipate yourselves from mental slavery, none but ourselves can free our minds. That is what Garvey was preaching.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not only economic, culturally, but mental slavery.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One more question, and then we're going to mm-hmm. move on and talk to Montel a while. What's the biggest challenge for you in directing this piece?
Well, the biggest challenge was to find actors that can portray the various characters. You needed to show the diaspora of what Marcus Garvey was talking about on stage, which means different kinds of black folks and different colorings, because a lot of the language in the play refers to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the most challenging thing, because a lot of times you can just go and audition people mm-hmm. and the best actor wins. In this case, the best actor was selected based on his adaptation for the role.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found casting to be one of the most difficult parts of, because once you get a good cast, half of your troubles are over.
Mm-hmm.
It's when you don't have a good cast, then, you know, you run into all kinds of problems.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Let's move over to Brother Montel. He's playing A. Philip Randolph, very important historical character. Can you talk about your approach and the biggest challenge you had in getting a handle on A. Philip Randolph?
Okay. My approach is pretty much always the same. My approach begins with a lot of research. I read and I read and I read. And I watch footage, and I just seek out so much information. And the reason for that is I am trying to understand these people. I'm trying to understand the people. I'm trying to understand the time period. So I read and I watch footage about the person that I'm portraying, about the time period, the 1920s, because, you know, a lot of times the way we see the world and the way we see each other and all these things are so much different now than they were back then. So I try to understand the time period, try to understand the language, the relationships, like how do I feel about this person that I'm talking to and that I'm referring to. And then the beautiful part about this piece is that it was filled with so many historical events that I just never knew about. I mean, mm-hmm. The East St. Louis riots and all these things that happened, and I was blown away because many of the things that took place then are things that are taking place now.
Right now.
So it's like, how much have we grown, really? So then what I'm also searching for in this research is our parallels from that time to my own life, so that I don't have to do any acting, really. Like, when mm-hmm. I find these parallels, for me, the way I describe it is trying on different jackets, and I'm trying to find a jacket that fits me. So all I have to do is just put it on and go on stage and just live out this event
mm-hmm.
with these other individuals, and I can tell the truth when I'm in these moments that, you know, instead of reaching for a truth, and if you're doing that, then nobody's gonna believe you, you know, because you're trying to, you're acting, really. So I research a whole lot, trying to find something that strikes me, something that means something to me, what my purpose is mm-hmm. in this story, and how to communicate that. That's my approach. Now, the challenge is the same thing, I think, trying to relate. That's the thing, like trying to relate. Because, you know, not everybody has lived in a situation where somebody threw a bomb in their house, or, you know, sent a severed limb to their office.
Yeah.
You know, nobody, you know, not many people know what that feels like to, you know, mm-hmm. just be hanging out, you know, having some juice, and then, you know, you open the door and there's a hand mm-hmm. that was sent to you. So that's always the challenge. That's mm-hmm. always the challenge, relating.
Okay.
But then once you can relate, then you can go out there and you can be truthful.
Okay. TJ, how about you? You play A. Philip Randolph and Easton.
Easton, yeah, an understudy. Well, as you guys can hear, it's my biggest challenge was my accent, which I'm still working on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think, yeah, that was my biggest challenge. For me, mostly when it comes to a character, especially a real person, I try to avoid not seeing too many footage of them, because mm-hmm. I don't want to, you know, like, imitate or do exactly what they do. You know, mm-hmm. so I always try to, at least I watch a little bit of A. Randolph just to have an idea how he looks. But I always try to avoid not getting too deep, you know, because I want to bring something into the character that's, you know, that's me.
Mm-hmm.
But also trying to channel, you know, the emotional. So mostly I always try to, you know, figure out each scene, what am I fighting for? You know, just mm-hmm. the fundamental of acting, you know, my objective, you know. on what am I fighting for? What am I looking for? What am I trying to to get at the end of the scene? So pretty much I just work on the fundamental of the basic steps of acting and try avoiding, you know, imitating the other character.
Now, how about when you have to create two characters, like one for Philip Randolph and one for Reverend Easton? What is your approach in relationship to that?
I always try to have a different definition for each character. Like, okay, you know, like the overall character, who is Randolph, who is Easton? You know, like, who, you know, who's this guy, was a pastor? And so he seems like very pleasant, nice. So I always try to distinguish their characteristic. You know, so I know when I'm playing Randolph, okay, this is his character, this is his characteristic, this is what he embodies. So if I, when I got that clear, it makes it very easy to just get into the role, because already, okay, he's a good or he's bad or he's nice or he's in between. Okay, I'm playing the nice one today, or I'm playing the in between, I'm playing the bad, you know, so I can just separate it that way.
Okay. You know? Okay, let's go over to Marcus Garvey over in Alexander. Let's talk about that for a while, the biggest challenge with this, and how did, what was your approach in getting into Marcus Garvey?
Well, my initial approach was to do what the director told me. He wanted me to really educate myself about Marcus Garvey and where he was coming from. And frankly, I didn't initially even look at the script. I wanted to understand the emotional place of Garvey, where he was coming from and his life. Through the reading, and I actually found one recording of a speech of his, listening to his pace, listening to his passion, hearing about where he came from and how his relationship with his father and how he did with the people that worked for him, that gave me a really strong idea of where he was coming from emotionally and what his ideas were. That made it easier to apply to the script. I have a hard time going the other way. If I read the script first, it jades the way I put the take on the character. And Marcus Garvey is way too powerful to have an idea going into it. I wanted to almost embody what he was portraying.
And what was the biggest, what did you find to be the biggest challenge with this role?
His constant power and passion, he never turned off. He didn't have downtime. My challenge was to be able to give these monologues and say these things in a fashion that he did, because he didn't turn off. It was amazing. Anything you've listened to that he's in, he doesn't change. He doesn't, his emotional space doesn't waver. The man believed in every syllable that came out of his mouth. And I wanted to portray that. And that, as some people might say, you have to develop your theater legs. I had to start working on that. It's an endurance race. It's not a sprint. That's a long run when you're being Marcus Garvey.
Okay. All right, we're going to come back to that. I wish it was okay with the director to do a couple of the scenes here, since we got Marcus Garvey. But let's move over to, but only if the actors is ready to do. We don't want to put them on the spot. let's move to Pedro.
Hello.
How you doing, Pedro?
Great.
Yeah, can you talk about, first of all, let's talk about a little of your background. How did you get off into theater, et cetera? When? And then we'll talk about your approach here.
Okay. Let's see. I majored in theater arts at Cal State Dominguez. I attained my bachelor's degree, and I went on from there and studied the Meisner Technique. And I went into the Robie Advanced Scene Study Workshop. I've always been one to want to consistently take workshops, classes, just really understand the fundamentals of what I want to do. And there's a lot of techniques out there. There's a lot of ways to learn. From there, I've just grown, and I've had the opportunity to be in some amazing pieces. And from there, it's led me to here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, can you talk a little about Amy Jacques and your approach in creating that character?
Yes, Amy Jacques, I don't... is an amazing character. I mean, I'm just honored to play her. I don't really see anything as a challenge when I was coming towards her. I've been more in awe of her, where she comes from, what she fought for, how she got her way here, and just, oh my God, she just was so she was such a powerful person in a time where women didn't have that plateau, that form to voice that and to be a part of something that build that. I felt like this woman is bigger than she could have been president if she was alive today. In researching her pieces and learning about her, I mean, I could go on, but I looked at that as more as an opportunity and experience to learn about her as a challenge. Mm-hmm. I'm falling in love with her and her story. Mm-hmm. And just applying it to the script and finding her where she was then. You know, she's 28 years old when we start out. So I'm like the young version of going back in her time of what she did and her relationship with her husband, and not just what she stood for and her principles, but her loyalty to love and her relationship. I've embodied that. I love mm-hmm. going through the process of finding that in Amy Jacques.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bill, if it's okay with the actors, can we do a little portion of that scene with Amy? You think you guys are ready for when Amy come in?
No, we haven't even rehearsed it yet, so I don't.
Yeah, so then you're of a challenge for the actors.
No, the medium is different, you know. So you have to look at it first.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Maybe if Alexander would do maybe half of his monologue, it would be.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel, Alexander?
Sure.
Yeah, let's do a piece of that. Which one, Bill?
Maybe the opening piece, just halfway.
Ethiopia shall stretch forth her hand unto God. Africa for the African, home and abroad. One God, one aim, one destiny. Up, you mighty race. You can accomplish what you will. Where is the black man's government? Where is his king and kingdom? Where's the black man's president, his country, his army, and his navy? I could not find them anywhere, so I declared, I will help make them.
Okay. Look. And we have to acknowledge that Melvin is the writer, the playwright. He has studiously avoided that all night. Well,
okay. Look, let's talk about the state of theater here in Los Angeles. Theater in the community. And do you make a separation out here in the professional world of theater and the community world of theater? Anybody want to pick up on that? And then, you know,
yes, I do. Los Angeles is a peculiar place. In New York, it's very close. Everybody lives pretty close together, and theater. A lot of actors go to New York primarily to do theater and so on. Here in Los Angeles, many actors come out here to do movies and TV. So theater is not as important to them, I think, as film. Mm-hmm. They do theater primarily to keep their love of theater going. I've done productions where I've lost actors to the movie industry. They got a part and they had to go. So that's what I see. Also, there is some community theater here. It's very difficult to maintain because you need the funding for these things. You need the people to come and see it. Mm-hmm. You need to do it in the particular neighborhood that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. So all these things are problematic. I was involved with a theater down in Leimert Park, which is now the Barbara Morrison Theater. And they did a lot of interesting work, but it was always difficult to get people to come into Leimert Park and not leave immediately. So that's one of the problems. But there are others. There's always money. There's always talented people who are doing other things rather than community theater. But I've always thought community theater was really the best theater.
Mm-hmm. A great training.
Yeah, great training for actors that that is sometimes useful, primarily because the theater is so different, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anybody else want to pick up on? This is a round table talking about your experience with our theater here, community theater, the challenges.
Well, for me, I really enjoy doing community theater. For a while, it was a challenge to do it because most times you have a 6 weeks rehearsal period and then you have a 6 weeks run. So to maintain your life during those times, depending on when you work, like if you work at night or whatever the situation is, it's hard to work and go to rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you work weekends, then it's hard to play and, you know, and work. So that from the perspective of an actor, that was hard to maintain. And then also what started to be a bit frustrating was that you put so much work into your role and many times no one would come and see it.
Mm-hmm.
So you then start to weigh, okay, well, why am I doing this? Because it's not for the money. You're passionate about it because you love the craft, but at the same time, you want to progress, you want to move yourself forward in your career. But if nobody is coming to see the excellent work that you're putting up, then it becomes a little bit discouraging because it's like, I mean, you're getting better, but you want people to see you.
Mm-hmm. You know? Okay, great point. Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to pick up on
that? I'll briefly say something. I've only done theater in Los Angeles, and it's not just the actors. It's also the work that's being put out there. And your piece, Catch the Tiger, Melvin, I think it is a responsibility to educate our community, and that is what community theater is about. And I love community theater, too, because it's a platform where we're able to educate and bring out things and awareness in our community or communities where we feel needs it. And it's not just the actors, it's the type of work we're putting out. And going back to what Bill said, it is important to keep funding it because I believe the arts is a huge platform for the generations after us. And we want to continue that as we continue on. So yeah, I do believe that doing pieces like this should remain in our community. And as a performer, I feel you. It is a challenge. And yes, this is what we chose. And this is our artistic playground because we do get better, you know? And this is Film Town. So it's hard to get people out to the theater because whether the amount of money you pay or, you know, the way you look at it, but it's art. And we still need it, and we still have to create it. And I think it's a fight with the funding, the money, and the community. But I think we have some really strong people around the Los Angeles community trying to maintain and keep pushing that forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then we're going to talk about, in a minute, I'm going to play a clip about when I asked a veteran actor what advice he would give the young actors out here, how to break into the business. We'll discuss that in a minute. But Stephen, what are your thoughts on community theater here and the ones that you've experienced back in Chicago and elsewhere?
Well, what is amazing about Los Angeles is that every time you turn a corner, there's a small theater. I think this 99-seat theater rule or law that's in effect is very productive. It creates a lot of opportunity. And just trying to cast this play, I'm amazed how many people are willing to audition for a play where there's no pay, just for the opportunity to act. And I hope that people come to see it once that kind of effort is invested that it takes. But no, I think community theater is wonderful, particularly given how much you have to pay for professional theater to go to the Disney or Geffen. So it's a very creative element. And I think the more theater gets organized and professionalized, the more it closes down, the less opportunities out there. I saw that happen at University of Chicago, where they had, when I was there years ago, court theater, which was strictly student and faculty, and anybody who wanted to put on a play could do it. And you could always get actors, and you could always get an audience. And there was no theater department, no acting department. But then they brought one in and hired faculty, had the same kind of admissions standards as other departments, and court theater didn't dry up. It went professional. Now it's extremely expensive. It's done by union actors, and it's right up there with the Goodman as one of the major theaters of Chicago. Oh. So theater, the open theater at University of Chicago is no longer there.
Okay. Look, I'd like to play a clip from David McKnight, veteran film and stage actor, and I asked him the question, what advice would he give to young actors out here in Los Angeles trying to break into the business?
Those characters, based on August Wilson's writing and a good director who, directed us toward that idea.
And you had a powerful lead actor also who you worked with before.
Yeah, my good friend Charlie Robinson, yes, great actor, and I love working with him. I worked with him before. And I have a lot of admiration and respect for his talent. It was good working with him. We had some good scenes together.
Now, I think you've already answered this, but I'm going to throw it out again. What advice would you give young actors, especially African-Americans, trying to break into the business?
I want to say that I have a buddy of mine brought his son to me. His son was about 12 years old. My son wants to be an actor, I said, what can you tell him to do? I said, first thing I told him, get a dictionary. Okay? Get a dictionary. He said, oh, yeah, get a dictionary. He said, well, he got the computer. I said, good, stay on that computer. Because as an actor, this is one thing. You get scripts, you get stories, and you get writers. You, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, you're an excellent writer, okay? And you know a lot of words. You know what I mean? Because you studied. Right? And a lot of writers are brilliant writers. August Wilson, they know a lot of different words. We're not close to all those words, but we got to understand those words. So, and that's one thing. You cannot, as an actor, go in auditioning or doing a play and not understanding the meaning of those words. I mean, thoroughly, completely. That is your responsibility. You got to know that. So first thing I tell a young person, starting off, of course, go to college, get as much education as you can, but get a dictionary, go to the computer, and understand that you got to know those words and break those words down. I've done plays with actors that can't pronounce the words, don't know the definition of the words and can't pronounce the words. That's a big, huge mistake.
Yeah.
You follow me?
Problem.
Because I mean, these especially writers in Hollywood, a lot of these writers in Hollywood and the Writers Guild and so forth, these are very brilliant, educated people. They come up with some words I never could imagine I'd ever heard. What the heck does that word mean? So I got to give respect to that and go to that computer, go to that dictionary and get a good, clear understanding of the definition and pronunciation of that word. Right. So I can say to young people trying to make it in the business, you know, understand that you must educate yourself in all aspects of training that you can. You can do dance, you can do it. Everything you can learn to do is going to be good for your acting. Dancing, singing, mime, you know, juggling, everything that you can do. Learn to do a whole lot of things. Riding a motorcycle, riding a bicycle, roller skating, ice skating, swimming. Everything you can do to enhance that instrument, if your body is your instrument. You learn how to use that instrument in many kind of ways. Kung fu, karate, everything you can do. You know, poetry, all kinds of stuff. You know what I mean? Don't be afraid to go venture out and learn things to enhance your instrument.
Okay, that was David McKnight's advice. Anybody want to pick up on that, what he was talking about?
I think he's 100% right. Mm-hmm. Acting is sharing life experience. If you don't have life experience to share, it's hard to be authentic. He's basically saying go out and live your life and be able to share that life that you're living as an actor. Mm-hmm. If you're not able to share those experiences, you're very limited as an actor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I was going to say, I agree with you, Alexander. We go into this audition saying, hire me, and what do you see me as? And you have to show them who you are and what you're capable of doing. And the only way you can do that is to know who you are and to understand yourself. So it's a balance. Like, go for it, you know, learn the fundamentals, definitely study, hone your craft, but you have to balance out life, because as actors, that's what we're doing. We're okay. Imitating life. So, yeah, you have to know who you are, too.
Okay. Anybody else want to pick up on that?
Yeah, I like what he said about understanding the words. I was taught, well, two things. I was taught in my training to look up every single word, even if you think you know the answer. Mm-hmm. Even if you think you know what the word means, still look it up. And I got training in doing that in a theater when I did Shakespeare. I did Othello. I did Lear. And, you know, I had a lexicon. And a lexicon is basically the dictionary, the Shakespearean dictionary. And you look up each word because you have to. You don't know the meaning of them, you know. And that helps you to understand what it is that you're saying. And also, for me, looking up the words is a part of the process that I mentioned earlier of relating to what's happening, relating to the circumstance, the scenario. And basically, when you're relating, you're trying to understand the meaning of what this is. So I agree with that 100%, definitely a vital step in the process of looking up the words and understanding what it is that you're trying to communicate to people.
Okay. TJ, what are your thoughts?
I mean, just what Monte was saying about words, because I'm in the Roby Theater class, and Ben recommended a book called
Action Verbs.
Action Verbs. Mm-hmm. It's just unbelievable when you open, like, okay, angry or persuade. It has so many, like, almost 10 different ways that you can say it or do, you know, do the action. You know, so what he said about knowing the words, when, you know, if you know the definition of the word, and you can pretty much, you know, you can use that and find it, you know, like what is similar to it or something closer to that, that you don't just have to be, I'm angry, but, you know, mm-hmm. it can be something else, mm-hmm. which means the same thing, but, you know, you can, you know, do it in a different way instead mm-hmm. of that one way.
Okay. Bill, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm actually a big fan of action words as well. I think it's a basic thing for actors to know what the role is. But one of the things that an actor needs to know is to the images that these words bring up. Because when you're on stage, that's what you use. You know, let's say you're playing Othello. You're in the modern day world, but you can use the words to visualize the images. And when you visualize the images, you're more adept at bringing the character forth. So those two suggestions are things that I am an advocate of.
Okay.
Yeah. The other thing that I'm really an advocate of is a lot of actors don't listen to each other. I think we don't put enough emphasis on listening. Mm-hmm. Listening, it's very, because if you listen to the actor, you respond better. Mm-hmm. You listen to the actors and what he's saying, you respond better. And I think that's three lessons that actors should really look at.
Okay. So, Stephen, can you once again give us the basic information about your reading that's coming up at the Vortex?
You mean the dates and such? Yes, it's a play called The Good Person of Bronzeville. God and Jesus come back to Earth, and they're looking for a good person, or rather Jesus is, because God has decided to wipe out mankind. He figures it has not lived up to its potential, and he wants a higher evolutionary stage. And Jesus says, no, this is a good race. We're going to, and if he can find one good person, the human race will be saved. So that's the setup of the play. It's the stage reading is Monday, October 26th, 7:30 p.m. at the Vortex, 2341 East Olympic in Los Angeles, admission free.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, we always have a section that we call the Lazarus Book Club, which is like to wake up the dead. And since this is our final show up until the first part of the year, the book that I want to recommend, which I think you'll find very interesting, is called The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop. So if you get a chance to read that book and want to read some early history of the historical background of the Messiah Jesus and the origins of the Catholic Church, excellent book to read. I want to thank our special guests, some of the cast members of Catch the Tiger, Stephen over here with the great play he got coming up. Please listen to past shows of the Qumran Report by Googling in Qumran Report. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. From your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, my co-host, Earlene Anthony. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. I leave you with Summertime, performed by Francie Joy and Jerome St. Jerome.